G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to Late Night Live. On tonight's program, we'll be thinking about two blokes who spent quite a lot of time in incarceration. One of them, Nelson Mandela, and then Julian Assange. I'll be talking to Julian in the Ecuadorian embassy, where he's been constrained for some considerable time. Then we're going to look at Kashmir, which has suddenly become a very popular tourist destination because of an outbreak of peace. But is it really peaceful peace, or is it just sort of, you know, bottled up conflict? Let me tell you a little story. I was the chair of the advisory board of the Centre for the Mind at the University of Sydney. And I don't know how we pulled it off, but we got Nelson Mandela to agree to open one of our conferences. Now, what made it tricky for me was that, as you know, I didn't get on too well with John Howard, and the feeling was entirely mutual. But the Prime Minister also was a patron of our organisation. And so the Vice-Chancellor explained to me that it would be my duty to introduce the Prime Minister, who would introduce Nelson Mandela. And I don't think either the PM nor I were looking forward to that sort of proximity on stage together. Anyway, half an hour before the great event, I get a call from Prime Minister's department. Do you really want to introduce the Prime Minister? No, I bloody well don't. It would be a bit hypocritical, said this voice on the phone. I said, not as hypocritical as John Howard introducing Nelson Mandela. Anyway, the whole thing was reconfigured. So what happened was, as I recall, I introduced the Vice Chancellor. He introduced John Howard. John Howard introduced Mandela. And then I got to do the wrap up later. Now, this meant that Mandela and I spent quite a lot of time in quiet conversation at an event fraught with tensions, because the other distinguished guest there was someone else that John Howard didn't like very much, and that's Malcolm Turnbull. Not Malcolm Turnbull, Malcolm Fraser. Oops, Freudian slip. Anyway, Fraser was being incredibly rude about John Howard, loudly, volubly, at the event. I found Mandela absolutely extraordinary. Well, of course you would. But in this game, you get to meet many of the great and the good, and not everyone sort of stands up to scrutiny. But here was a secular saint right up there with Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and I've just found him absolutely captivating. I get very cynical and sceptical, and am rarely in awe of people, but I was with Mandela. So it's very sad to realise how crook he is in hospital at the moment. So I thought what we'd do is discuss the life and times of this 94-year-old hero with John Carlin. John's a friend of the program, of course. He was the South African bureau chief for The Independent from 1989 to 1995, really crucial years, because Mandela was elected in 1994. John's now a senior writer for El País, which is the world's biggest Spanish-language newspaper, and he also writes for lots of the English language biggies like the Financial Times and The Observer. And he's on the blower from Barcelona, wherein he now dwells. Welcome back to the program, John.
Pleasure to be here, Philip.
Now, you were, as I said, in South Africa at exactly the right time for a foreign correspondent, weren't you?
I certainly was. I consider it the great good fortune and privilege of my professional life to have been there at that time, and not least to have got to know Nelson Mandela about as well as one could hope to do as a humble, toiling journalist.
You hold him in very high regard, don't you?
Well, I just want to pick up on what you were just saying a few moments ago, Philip. I don't know anybody who has spent any time in the presence of Mandela the way that you did that time, sort of quality time, one-to-one, who has not come away, as you were, absolutely captivated by him. And he is precisely, again, as you said, a sort of cynicism killer. We journalist types...
I like that, a cynicism killer.
Yeah, and I mean, we journalists do, you know, inevitably become, to say the least, sceptical about politicians over the course of our lives. And Mandela is the one sort of glaring... great beam of light, and I can attest to the fact that, you know, every single journalist that I knew in South Africa, foreign correspondent that was there in those epic times, was absolutely sort of surrendered to his charm and integrity. I was recently talking to a very good friend of mine who was the South African correspondent for the New York Times at the, when I was there, Bill Keller, who was then editor of the New York Times for 7 years. And he, you know, we were talking in New York recently, and he was saying that of the many, many, many famous people and great political leaders and so forth that he's met, Mandela absolutely stands head and shoulders above the rest of them.
And John, he could have come out of that terrible experience of long-term imprisonment bitter, angry, and dangerous.
Yes, I mean that's a point that is oft made, and I think it's important to maybe draw a bit of a distinction between him and Gandhi, the committed pacifist, in the sense that Mandela wasn't. I mean, Mandela was the person who led, who started the armed struggle of the African National Congress back in 1961. And if, when he came out of prison, he opted for the road of peace, it wasn't out of, benevolence and kindness, or at least not that alone. It was chiefly because he judged that the most effective, most pragmatic means of achieving his lifelong goals, namely democracy and peace, would be through negotiations and through a policy of reconciliation. He himself had reasons for bitterness, and I'm quite convinced harbored bitterness deep in his heart. But out of political necessity, he kept that very, very well hidden most of the time, and like I say, opted for a policy of reconciliation, but chiefly out of political canniness.
John, tell the listener about his dealings with that former military commander, the general who was charged with heading the white freedom struggle.
Yeah, that's one of my favourite Mandela stories, and it's I tell it in detail in a book that I wrote about Mandela. Well, there was a man called General Constant Viljoen, who was an Afrikaner, and he was the head of the South African Defence Force between 1980 and 1985, which were times of great stress and immense state repression. He was basically the enforcer of the apartheid system, which obviously could not have been sustained without military might. And then he went into retirement, but then in 1993, the massed ranks of the extreme right of South Africa, who were divided into all kinds of small factions, decided to try and come together, and they held a sort of Nuremberg rally in a small town south of Johannesburg, at which I was present, and there were sort of lots of swastika-like emblems around and black uniforms and an extremely sinister spectacle. And at this event, General Viljoen was called upon by the massed ranks of the extreme right to go on stage, whereupon they anointed him as their leader, and he accepted this role and declared the start of what he called the second great Boer freedom struggle, the first having been in the war against the British at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. So that's the background. Then off he went and started setting up clandestine, what I would call terrorist cells. He would have called them freedom fighter cells around the country. Mandela got wind of this and knew that here lurked the greatest possible peril to his dream of democracy and peace. He held secret talks at his home with General Constant Viljoen. I could go into immense detail on what went on there, what transpired there, but basically Mandela disarmed him through what I referred to before as this extraordinarily seductive cocktail he has of charm, of charisma, and integrity. And over the course of several more secret conversations, the general decided to abandon this so-called armed struggle. And not only that, he gave his legitimacy to the whole Mandela project by taking part in the country's first ever democratic elections.
And John, I love your description of one encounter where he's dumbstruck by Mandela's warmth and by his attentiveness to detail. Quote, "Do you take sugar in your tea, General?"
Yes. Exactly. No, and this was, you know, I told it in the book, as the general told it to me some years later when we had a long conversation in Cape Town. And that's right. What happened, he arrived at Mandela's house. I mean, imagine, as far as General Viljoen was concerned, Mandela was South Africa's very own Osama bin Laden. you know, except, you know, but the difference being that he was, you know, in terms of how the Americans would view Osama bin Laden, he was right there, you know, on his doorstep, literally. And Mandela invited him into the house with his delegation of sinister, sinister generals. Trust me, I knew these guys. And he told the general, listen, why don't we, you and I have a little private chat before we get on with our more formal meeting. And they sat down, and Mandela said to him, General, do you take tea? And the general said, yes, I do, thank you. And he said, General, do you take milk? He said, yes, I do. Mandela poured the milk. And he said, do you take sugar? And he said, yes, one. Mandela put in the sugar. And as the general said to me, all I had to do was stir it. And so even before they started talking, you know, all these kind of ghosts and nightmare images that Soon-Yun had developed over his life about Mandela just dissolved before his very eyes.
As did the sugar. Forgive the bad pun, but it was a stirring occasion. Now, John, you posed a rhetorical question in something you wrote about Mandela. Let me quote, or let me rephrase it. How did he convince his enemies to succumb to his will?
Yeah. Well, I just talked before about this seductive political cocktail. I mean, what politicians are all about is seducing people, conquering hearts and minds, winning them over, winning people over to their point of view. And I'm certainly not aware in my life of anyone who comes close to Mandela in doing this in seemingly impossible circumstances. The fact of the matter is that he persuaded the vast bulk of the white population of South Africa, who, I repeat, had been programmed over years to see him as a menace, as a terrorist, as the worst possible sort of phantasm in their lives, he convinced them not only that he was their rightful president and to succumb to him as their rightful president, but they actually came to view him with extraordinary affection. And you'd be very, very hard pushed in South Africa to find anybody, black or white, who doesn't hold Mandela in the highest esteem. What does this cocktail consist of? Well, I've said before, you know, tremendous integrity that shines through, you know, that he's a man of his word, who is there's a coherence between what he says publicly and what he does privately. Second, there is this charisma, which I think one way to describe charisma is a vast, vast self-confidence. And then at another level, Mandela had the wit to understand that in order to get your way in politics, you have to know your enemy. He understood the Afrikaners. He got to learn to speak their language. He learned their history. He managed to get himself into their skin and to understand their fears and aspirations. And you put all that together, plus always treating his rivals, his enemies, with respect. You put all that together, and it's a very, very difficult, like I say, seductive cocktail to be immune to.
Well, as you've written elsewhere, he showed it's possible to be a great human being and a great politician
at the same time.
Now, let's point out that he's still alive and kicking, and we hope that he stays alive for some considerable time. So this is not a valedictory piece. It's just a recognition that he stood head and shoulders above every leader of his generation and, one might add, practically every leader there has ever been.
I think so. I mean, I think that in terms of political skill, I think the only person contemporary times that you could maybe put at his level would be Bill Clinton. It's just the difference is that Mandela operated on a more elevated moral stage.
Look, thanks very much for that, John. It's good to talk to you again. John was speaking to us from Barcelona, where he's now choosing to live for all sorts of complicated reasons. This is LNL on RN, and as I promised you, I'm about to talk to someone else who knows well what it's like to be incarcerated, although in a rather different way than Mandela was on Robben's Island. LNL on RN. Okay, let's now talk to the world's most famous refugee, or if you prefer, fugitive. Julian Assange has been holed up now in the rather grim, unprepossessing Ecuadorian embassy for 6 months. And as I reported when I saw him a couple of months ago, he wasn't looking too well, even paler than you remember him, and with a dreadful cough. And I know his mother has been increasingly concerned about his health. I don't know if there's any good news from Julian about his circumstances, but I'm also concerned about the circumstances of WikiLeaks itself, because it's been in danger following the announcement by, following Visa's decision to create a sort of barricade, a financial barricade around WikiLeaks in the hope of, suffocating it, I guess. And now the European Commission said that the credit card company wasn't breaking the law by blocking donations. Nonetheless, health problems notwithstanding, Julian has just co-authored another book called Cyberpunks, Freedom and the Future of the Internet, and he's on the blower from the aforementioned embassy in London. Julian, how are you feeling? Let's start with your health.
G'day, Phil. It all seems a bit remarkable and dramatic when I hear things summed up that way, but I've gotten rather used to everything that's happening.
But you do have a chronic lung infection, Julian, don't you?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but the circumstances are difficult. I'm not denying that they're difficult. On the other hand, I've been in worse positions. Solitary confinement was worse. 2 years under house arrest, going to the police station every day at a certain time with a manacle around my leg was worse. And other people associated with our organisation have been in considerably worse positions. The last 2 weeks, Bradley Manning, one of our alleged sources, has been fighting the US military over their treatment of him, where he was detained, where he has been detained for 928 days so far without trial. That's the longest detention without trial in US military history of a soldier, where he was put in tiger cages in Kuwait, 8x8x8 cages in a tent in Kuwait, where they altered his environment such that the lights went on at 11 p.m. And off at 2 p.m. in order to destabilize him. This is what's been coming out in these remarkable hearings the past 2 weeks, where they took his glasses off, where they stripped him naked, all the sorts of things we normally associate with the interrogation regime against alleged suspects of Al-Qaeda, but in this case done to a U.S. soldier, this type of no-touch torture that the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, in investigating his case, formally found against the United States, saying that his treatment was equivalent to torture.
When I saw you, Julian, you were terribly concerned by what you were calling economic censorship and the fact that WikiLeaks was losing, about 95% of the donations flow it had had, thanks to the blockade imposed in December 2010. Any good news there?
There's a lot of interesting news. This blockade is, I suppose, if you go back and if you pull back and look at what WikiLeaks has taught us about the world, well, it's not just our publications, it's the reaction, ongoing reaction to those publications, showing how modern censorship is practiced in the West. And, their attempts to get up as new legislation in the U.S. Congress to turn us all into terrorists where we could be taken out extrajudicially, that didn't succeed. There was an attempt to activate the U.S. Treasury and blockade us like Cuba is blockaded in a formal blacklist. That didn't succeed. Guyton threw it out on the 13th of January 2011. So none of the formal mechanisms succeeded. Instead, Lieberman and Peter T. King, reactionary figures in Congress and the Senate, went behind the scenes and worked their networks in Washington and managed to get Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Bank of America, Western Union, MasterCard, Diners Club, Discover, money bookers, etc., to erect this extrajudicial, extraterritorial financial blockade against us. And we took a case against it in Iceland, where one of our bank accounts is, and won that case. And Visa has appealed it to the Supreme Court.
We've filed now, just recently, another case against it in Denmark, and it's listed to be heard in the Danish courts. We've taken an 18-month investigation against it at the European Commission, and the preliminary finding is they may be able to get away with that under European trust law. The European Parliament, just 2 weeks ago, however, has now passed a resolution for the Commission to draft new legislation European-wide to prevent the credit card companies doing that to any European organisation. So that's a major advance. And we've just had another finding, a two-year fight in relation to our charitable status in Germany, where our charitable status was attempted to be revoked as a result of political interference by a CDU interior minister in Hessen. That came out in Der Spiegel just a month ago, just political interference. But we've won. And now we have EU-wide tax deductibility. And in the United States, where more than 40% of our donations came from, there's a new initiative which unfortunately has been delayed by just a couple of days. I can't tell you exactly what it is. But there's a new foundation that has been created with Daniel Ellsberg and other luminaries on the board that is going to give us US-wide charitable status.
I understand the European Commission released statements from Gillard as well as Joe Lieberman, and that these were crucial in getting that financial blockade to happen. So our Prime Minister was not much help to you.
That's right. MasterCard Australia has admitted previously that Gillard was involved in relation to MasterCard Australia, that they took those statements of the Prime Minister as license to justify their blockade. But what we saw in the European Commission documents is that Visa and MasterCard are using Gillard's statement as the second statement in their compendium of statements by politicians as the reason to impose the blockade internationally. So that's the Visa MasterCard US. Now, a really interesting thing has come out of the Commission in relation to these card companies. So if you think about it, nearly everyone has a Visa MasterCard in their pocket, and it is the world's largest small transaction currency. So if we want to exclude land purchases and oil deals and so on, Visa and MasterCard together, for instance, had a 97% duopoly in the European market. But what do we really know about how these companies work? Well, there's there's no sovereignty in any nation without economic sovereignty. And Visa and MasterCard can simply exercise an extrajudicial, extraterritorial economic drone strike against any Australian corporation or European corporation and cut it off, just delete it from economic existence, which is what they've tried to do with us. And there's no administrative or judicial process so far that can stop it, even if you win them.
Yeah.
How it's set up in Australia mirrors the European Union, is that there is a MasterCard Australia, there is a Visa Europe, which is registered here in London. But these are just fictions. It's what the European Commission has come to call a network of undertakings. So the ownership structure is completely divorced from the control structure. Normally, we think of a company or a network of companies, if you look to see who owns it, you can just sort of follow the money in terms of ownership, and you'll understand who controls what. But these companies are constructed in such a way where the control structure is mediated through secret contracts. Nominally, Visa Europe and MasterCard Australia are owned by Australian banks or European banks, but actually they're controlled in terms of who they do business with from the United States.
I have to ask you this. Any ongoing conversations with Sweden on the, you know, in the hope of getting that assurance that you wouldn't be extradited to the US?
Sweden have refused to offer any such assurance. The Ecuadorian government has formally requested of them that they offer a diplomatic assurance that I not be extradited to the United States. They have refused. The UK also legally has an ability to, if it extradited me to Sweden, to demand that the Swedes not onwards extradite me. The UK government has refused. It is the nature of these states that they will never, ever formally say no to anything that might infuriate the United States. That's my opinion. However, there are developments in Sweden that are extremely beneficial, I think, politically, and that the Swedish case is likely to be dropped in the first 6 months of next year. That's my take on things. One of the principal characters involved is politician Claes Borgström, who resurrected the case in Sweden 1 month out from the election. He was running for Minister for Justice for the equivalent of the Swedish Labour Party. He is now embroiled in the worst judicial scandal in modern Swedish history, the case of Thomas Quick. And emails have come out that they're called Quickie Leaks, which are all about how Claes Borgström has been corresponding since August with a Supreme Court judge trying to frame one of his clients who was falsely sentenced for 8 murder convictions across 6 separate murder trials.
Under international law, Australia has the right, at least the right, to take up the claim of one of its nationals where the nationals' rights have been violated under international law and assert those rights against another country. Tell me that there are ongoing negotiations with Australia on your behalf.
I mean, it's very interesting to see how these things play out. So before I was in this situation, I often heard of some Australian in trouble overseas, and then you have the foreign minister coming out and saying how much they're helping them, etc. This is nearly always a lie. And I know from direct experience, and a few other Australians like McCall, he was trapped in Egypt, a journalist there, who in fact received very little assistance. In his case, he did get some at the very end and everything was cleared up. In my case, the last thing that's happened is that the government, the Ecuadorian government in Quito, was contacted by the Australian Foreign Affairs Office and said, oh, we're concerned about Julian's health. What's your emergency program? You know, if something happens to him, we can perhaps give money, we can advise, etc. And the Quito government said, fine, okay, let's set up an appointment here in London. So the consul here from this embassy, a very nice man by the name of Fidel, met with the Australian consul to London at the Australian High Commission. And what was the result of that? The result of that was that the Australian government gave a list of numbers for doctors in the London area. That was all that they would do. There was no... they had offered to pay bills, they had offered to do various things. None of that actually eventuated. So there had been some shift within foreign affairs or within cabinet between those 2 points. But of course it infuriated the Ecuadorians that they had been run around to all these meetings, and the result of which is that we received a list of doctors which in all advisability I should never ever have anything to do with.
Julian, long before you were born, I vividly recall another famous long-term incumbent in an embassy, and that, of course, was the Hungarian Catholic Cardinal Mindszenty, who spent 15 years from 56 to 71 under the protection of the US embassy in Budapest. You must, from time to time, see yourself following in his footsteps.
Well, look, Phil, the position here is difficult. On the other hand, we must understand that the position faced by the organisation and its supporters is also difficult, and there are bigger, you know, bigger political, there are bigger interests at play, not just against us, but also people who support what we're doing. And the position I have here means that we're able to effectively focus some attention on what the organisation is going through, but also on the principles that we believe in. So I don't see my situation here as altogether unhelpful. The big threat that I personally face is the ongoing US investigation. As of December last year, the FBI portion of that alone, and there are over a dozen US agencies involved, has come out in open court that is more than 42,135 pages so far, and less than 9,000 of those relate to the Bradley Manning case. The rest are other aspects of my activities and the organization's activities. We've discovered a tender that was put out by the Department of Justice. It's some great work done by our people looking at these little details. The tender put out this year for a WikiLeaks case management system of $1 to $2 million. So that's what they're spending just on a computer system to manage the case notes for the prosecution to come. On September 28th, the Pentagon formally renewed its threats to us through its spokesperson to ABC News, saying that our publications were an ongoing crime, an ongoing illegal activity before law enforcement, and us as an organization simply requesting submissions from the US military, just the request, they call it solicitation, was an ongoing crime. So not only material that we previously published about Iraq revealing the deaths of 100,000 people or Afghanistan, they say was a crime, but actually the very heart of the organization, its ongoing existence, they say, is a continuous crime.
Oh dear. Julian, it's good to talk to you. We haven't got time on this occasion to discuss the new book, but it's quite remarkable, and perhaps we can resume our conversation early in the new year. Incidentally, I understand that there's an Ecuadorian national election coming up, and both the US and the UK are concerned there's a bit of a waiting game.
Well, that's what our insiders say in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office here, that the UK has been advised by the US don't do anything until after the Ecuadorian election, and some reports have come out that the US has increased its anti-Korea funding for the various aid agencies it has operating in Ecuador to $87 million, a tripling after the Chavez win. However, President Correa, the last poll put him at 52%. That's 32 points ahead of his nearest competitor. So,
a comfortable margin, Julian. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the most popular. He is the most popular leader in Latin America, and as of last year, I'm not sure the up-to-date polls, he was the second most popular Democratic, the elected leader in the world.
I'm now going to ludicrously suggest that you have a happy Christmas. Julian, thanks for talking to me. Julian Assange, founder, editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, now, of course, the world's most famous refugee in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Coming up on LNL, Peace in Kashmir? The no-hatter mask is known as the Gaza Strip of Kashmir. Till about 2 years ago, young blokes would get together to pray at the mosque, and after prayer they'd throw stones at the security forces, and on most occasions violence would reliably erupt. Kashmir, of course, long a flashpoint between India and Pakistan. A line of control divides the region in two, one administered by India, one by Pakistan. Today, however, the mosque is where tourists gather for their official walking tour of the crafts and heritage markets. After a gap of 23 years, and this will astonish you, close to 1 million tourists have flocked into India's most sensitive state this year. Now, does that mean that the popular appetite for dissident politics is now lost, or is peace an enforced calm? On the blower from New York is Mohammed Junaid, a doctoral student in anthropology at the City University of New York. His research focuses on issues of space violence and militarization in Kashmir. He grew up there in the 1990s and witnessed the rise of resistance against Indian rule. We're trying also to make contact with our regular commentator from the subcontinent, Pramod Pal Chaudhuri, who's the foreign editor of the Hindustan Times. But while we await that connection, I'd like to put this issue to you, Mohammed. It would seem that the appetite for dissent, I'm sorry, for dissident violent politics is pretty well over in Kashmir.
Well, hi. Well, not really so much, because one has to understand that there is an extensive security crackdown that has been happening over the last few years after the major protests in 2008, and then in 2010, most of the separatist leaders have been either jailed at one point or the other, or the people who are described as stone pelters, they have been continuously surveillanced, arrested, they're having charges slapped on them. So, there are 700,000 Indian soldiers still in India, and some people estimate that there are, for every 10 Kashmiris, there is an Indian armed soldier present.
Well, there's 700,000 Indian soldiers in Kashmir spread out among the civilian population.
Yeah, spread among the civilian population. They control, hilltops, they control orchards, streets. They are present everywhere. And in the hospitals, in colleges, you see bunkers everywhere. So it's a huge security grid which controls the local population. So most people are actually terrified of the situation, because there have been extensive human rights violations over the last few years. I mean, there had been many more human rights violations previously, but the ones that have happened recently have been mostly done in a climate where there is mostly no Kashmiri armed activity. The protests have been largely non-violent, and so the people who have been affected by state violence, they say that there are no, the state has not taken any steps to stop these human rights violations. So the dissident politics, in fact, is really not dead in Kashmir. It's just rest for the moment.
Well, so everyone's under a pretty repressive state apparatus, and there's the constant threat of incarceration and humiliation. What was it like growing up in Kashmir in the 1990s when you witnessed the rise of resistance against Indian rule, Mohammed?
Well, initially, I was 10 years old when the armed movement erupted, but, there were many local men who actually suddenly came back. They went to the Pakistani side of Kashmir, and within a few months and with barely any training, they came back, and there was a lot of euphoria everywhere. People believed that the independence for Kashmir was not far away. But within a few months of that, Indian Army, which had already been present in significant numbers in Kashmir, probably around 300,000 soldiers were already there, but they were mostly based in barracks and not among the civilians. They fanned out, and new paramilitary forces came in who occupied, suddenly would see the transformation of space in Kashmir. It became impossible to walk through streets without being continuously cautious that somebody might just shoot you. And people were dying in dozens every day, and there were many occasions where, crowds were shot at, and dozens of people died. And I lost friends who were in school at that time, some of them 11 years old, 10, 12 years old, who were caught up in either crossfire or got injured in grenade attacks or whatnot. It was a very terrible atmosphere at that time. We lost a lot of school days during that time, and people were soon, by 1991, everybody became unsure of what was going to happen, and it seemed that it was going to be a long-drawn affair. Some people who could leave left, but others who couldn't, they just had to be there and deal with the consequences.
This is LNL on RN, and we're talking about the future of India's most fragile state, Kashmir, with anthropologist Mohammed Juaid, and no, not with journalist Pramit Pal Chaudhary, who's gone missing in action. Mohan, but put on your anthropological hat and tell me what it is that defines or sets the Kashmiri people apart. What are the defining characteristics?
I think the defining characteristics are more political than anything. I would say that Kashmir has historically been sort of a space where both Central and South Asian cultures kind of had a huge influence. And Kashmiris obviously have a distinct language, but their South Asia in general has a lot of linguistic diversity. So my understanding is that it's the political aspects, especially the flawed partition, in 1947, which left subcontinent divided between India and Pakistan, and created artificial boundaries and created these two monstrous states, which were highly centralized, did not care about smaller nationalities and ethnic minorities. That's one of the primary reasons that Kashmir became a focal point, because it had a largely Muslim population and, according to the logic of partition, should have gone to Pakistan. And it had contiguous borders with Pakistan. The rivers flowed into Pakistan. It was connected by roads to Pakistan. But Kashmiris, it must be said that the majority of Kashmiris actually do not want to be part of Pakistan, nor do they want to be part of India.
Yeah.
They want to be independent. So Kashmiris have become highly political over these last many decades. And this is what defines Kashmiris as, I would say, distinct than other nationalities in either India and Pakistan, who may have accepted one or the other form of political arrangement with their respective states.
As the name Mohammed more than hints, we're talking about an overwhelmingly Islamic community, and yet most of the Indian tourists are Hindus who rarely eat in Muslim-owned restaurants. And you write that the huge influx of people from the Indian plains puts the ecologically fragile pilgrim route in great peril.
Yeah. Well, the pilgrimage route is definitely in great peril, because for this yatra, the journey, the pilgrimage has been going on for many decades. And it was a 15-day affair where several thousand pilgrims would come and walk all the way to this 45-mile trek, which was part of this Hindu tradition that it had to be an arduous trek for it to have religious significance. But over the last few years, and actually the 2008 uprising in Kashmir was because of this government grant of land to a non-official body which controls the journey to build permanent structures there. Now, one has to understand that area has glaciers. It's the water source for throughout the summers for not only Kashmir but also the plains of Pakistan, which has seen drought and floods off and on recently. And the government has been continuously trying to build structures, build roads there. And it will definitely put the entire ecosystem there into deep peril. And they have also increased the length of the journey, the pilgrimage, from 15 days first to 1 month and then to 2 months, which has now recently been brought down again to 1 month. And not only are thousands coming, but hundreds of thousands of people move there. They throw garbage, they throw refuse there, and which has become a huge problem, because this kind of matter will remain there. It's a very cold place with no government program to clean it up.
Mm.
So that becomes a huge ecological problem. Otherwise, like, Kashmiris in general are very hospitable people. They have never had any problems with the pilgrimage at all.
My guest is Mohammed Junaid, who's an anthropologist. Well, he's a doctoral student in anthropology at the City University of New York. Now, I imagine, Mohammed, that the Indians flooding in would have a rather warped view of what Kashmir is all about. Wouldn't they see it through the prism of a fair bit of propaganda?
In general, the Indian media has not presented an accurate picture of Kashmir, despite the fact that it's become pretty clear that the only reason there is resentment in Kashmir is because of the presence of the military. And there is a law called Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which has been in place since 1990, and under which, people can be arrested, people can be tortured, and information can be extracted from them. And no armed forces personnel can be prosecuted for human rights violations. So this is a pretty draconian kind of situation with the basic fundamental rights of people not cared for. But the Indian media has not presented any such an accurate picture. The debates that have been happening on Indian media about this law, for instance, or the army presence in Kashmir has been more nationalistic, more belligerent, and often, often narrow-minded.
Yeah.
And I think that many Indian tourists who come to Kashmir either have a very romantic view of Kashmir as this beautiful paradise which has been ruined by its inhabitants, or they have this view that Kashmiris are in general very hostile people to outsiders, which is not correct either.
I haven't asked you the most obvious question. How do you explain this extraordinary influx in tourism? If you have to go back to 1987 to see this sort of enthusiasm for Kashmir as a tourist destination?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is that the Indian middle class has expanded over the years. They have, they travel a little bit more than previously. The second and the most significant reason has been an active government involvement in, inviting people to come to push tourism. And often the government, it's not like Kashmiris do not like tourism. I mean, it helps a small segment of population, but nevertheless, it does help. It provides some employment. Yet the Indian government has been using tourism as a way of saying that Kashmir is normal and people are ready to move on. But if Kashmir is normal, the obvious question that Kashmiris ask is why are there 700,000 Indian soldiers present there? Why is there such a deep security infrastructure?
Yeah.
But for that, in the Indian government has no answer, because tourism has been sort of used as a propaganda tool to say that Kashmiris no longer want their political rights. So it has become a discursive sort of it has become an issue among Kashmiri civil society and political society that they have come to resent some of the discourse about tourism.
My guest, dear listener, recently described what it's like to step out of the terminal at the airport. It is clear you have not arrived at a typical tourist resort, surrounded by camouflaged army barracks, guarded by an unusually large number of unsmiling armed soldiers. It feels more like a military installation than a tourist hotspot. Tourists are hastily driven off to lakeside hotels or houseboats or to mountain valleys and meadows. So they're put in a bubble, aren't they?
They certainly are. And this is one of the ironies, of the situation, that if anything prevents tourists from coming to Kashmir, it is the overwhelming presence of military everywhere. They have occupied hotels, they're present in the meadows and orchards, the places normally that tourists would go. And so when the government keeps saying that tourism is the key to Kashmir's prosperity, they are at the same time undermining it by, you know, not having a sincere dialogue about the military infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, by not withdrawing militarily from, you know, civilian regions in Kashmir or sending their military back to the barracks. Your friend is absolutely right. When you land in Srinagar Airport, there are four different levels. It's not a civilian airport anymore. There is no civilian airport in Kashmir. It's a military airport which has been turned into a civilian airport. There are, you find military jets around, which is funny for a tourist place for not to have a tourist infrastructure. A welcoming tourist infrastructure.
Mohammed, we've been talking about the fragility of Kashmir. We're talking about environmental fragility, political fragility, but also, of course, economic fragility. This is an extraordinary fact. The state receives just £72 million each year in taxes, yet the salary bill for the 500,000 public employees alone is more than double that. This is a country without really an economy.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is a huge dependency politics. Kashmir, the government has been trying to employ more and more people in a sector which is highly inefficient, which is the government sector. You know, a lot of people have been employed at the rate of perhaps $100 a month, you know, which is actually keeping them rather poor, instead of giving them any life opportunities. Kashmiri economy has largely been based on horticulture, like growing of apples, and there's handicraft. But by themselves, they are not enough to sustain a population in a modern economy. And much of the, you know, significant percentage of Kashmir's economy is subsidized by Indian taxpayer money. And I think that many economists in Kashmir, especially from Kashmir University, would argue that the Kashmir economy has been, you know, deliberately kept on its knees. There is no, the bureaucratic hassles to set up businesses, start new ventures, to send money to Kashmir.
Mohammed, forgive me interrupting, but we're absolutely and utterly out of time. But it's a pleasure to talk to you. Mohammed Junaid from the City University of New York, who teaches at Lehman College. On our final live program for the year, we've gathered together, or we will, a number of political, religious and economic pundits, and we're going to look back on the year that was. I shall mingle with Tingle. Laura's back. Dennis Atkins from the Courier Mail, Sajid Das, and Dr. Paul Collins, my own personal Catholic priest. Before we go, I'd like to thank one of our long-time listeners, Chris Tooley, for Brisbane, for his Christmas present to the program, a koala stamp. It's the most wonderful stamp, and I hope to get to use it very often next year. Stick around now to RN, and we will see you later.